All right, y'all, welcome to the show. I got a big one for you. So Congress passed a law that declares you a Jew hater. That's only the slightest exaggeration that I could come up with. You'll see, pretty disgusting. We'll get to anti-genocide protesters shutting down the Golden Gate Bridge. Senator Tom Cotton threatens violence against peace protesters. Then later on, we have Cenk Uygur debates a warmonger on Piers Morgan. There's a bombshell story about the New York Times getting caught lying. Trump versus RFK, that is now getting spicy, and they're lobbing bombs at each other. And then probably one of the most important stories here, the Supreme Court just took a sledgehammer to the First Amendment, and nobody seems to notice or care. So I'm going to give you the specifics of that. I got to be honest, man, the thing that's been on my mind, I went deep down the rabbit hole of the rap battle going on right now, the warring diss tracks. We got Kendrick Lamar and J. Cole, even though he retracted and apologized, and Drake, and now Rick Ross, and I'm following all that stuff closely. No, I'm not doing a segment on it. I'm not enough of a hip-hop head to get away with that and give, a solidly grounded opinion. But I will say this. I think Rick Ross's track was fire, and he was kind of irrelevant until dropping this diss. I feel like he's been in the wilderness for like 5 years or whatever it's been. And I'm like one of the biggest Drake haters on the planet, but I think his diss track was kind of fire too. So anyway, those are my thoughts. I could talk about this for like an hour, but I'm not going to do that. So we're going to go ahead and jump into it here. Everybody do me a big favor. Please subscribe to the channel. Helps out massively in the algorithm, costs you nothing. And let's do it. So this dropped yesterday in a 377-44 vote and one person voting present. The House of Representatives passed a resolution that defines the slogan, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," as anti-Semitic, and they condemned it. I'll give you some more specifics here. So there's only one Republican that voted against officially declaring "From the river to the sea" as anti-Semitic. That, of course, is Thomas Massey. For those of you who don't know, he's kind of like the heir apparent to the Ron Paul throne. He's like a hardcore libertarian, so every now and then he'll surprise you with a vote like this. But the other 43 no votes were Democrats. You have people like Ilhan Omar, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Of course, you have Rashida Tlaib in here. Then you have a bunch of other. I mean, the fact of the matter is over 70% of the Democrats also voted to condemn it and say that "From the river to the sea" is anti-Semitic. Right now, as you all know, Congress is in the midst of aiding and abetting a genocide, sending weapons and money to Israel, even though we have all the evidence in the world that they're targeting civilians, that they're bombing public infrastructure, that they're unleashing holy hell on the heads of women and babies. We know all of that. In the midst of sending them more money and weapons to do more war crimes, they decide to throw pro-Palestine protesters under the bus and officially declare them anti-Semitic. So there's a few things to say in response to this. I mean, the most obvious one is this. You do know that the Likud party, Netanyahu's party, "From the river to the sea" is in their charter. That is one of the things they say. They want a greater Israel. They want Israeli control from the river to the sea. They've said that. Have you ever heard anybody in Congress come out and say, "I condemn that, that's anti-Palestinian hatred," or "that's Islamophobia"? No, nobody says anything when Israelis say that. But when pro-Palestine protesters say, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," all of a sudden, it's a national scandal and people melt down and you start hurling accusations. Now, by the way, the thing that pisses me off the most about this is that they know it's not true. So are there instances of some people, when they say "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," that what they mean is, let's expel every Jewish person or every Israeli from the region, you know, let's force them out, let's do an ethnic cleansing in that direction? I have no doubt that when you see a video of one of the top Hamas officials on some Iranian news program saying "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," and he says it within the context of, "we're going to do another October 7th and another October 7th and another October 7th, I have no problem condemning that guy in that context using that phrasing. But what they're specifically doing here is going after, like, college protesters who are saying, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. And if you just ask those people, hey, what do you mean when you say from the river to the sea? They'll tell you in no uncertain terms, and I know because I've done this, I've asked them, I've gotten their perspective. Their perspective is, what we want is one state in the region and a secular democracy for all. We want equality. We want justice. We want peace. We want Palestinians and Israelis to live and all have human rights and voting rights, and that's our end goal. So how can you look at somebody who has that perspective and then turn around and say, sorry, you're an anti-Semite. Sorry, you're a Jew hater. Sorry, what you just said is condemnable. It's so ironic because the actual position being espoused by the college kids who are saying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, the actual position is one in favor of democracy, one in favor of one person, one vote, one in favor of, hey, your background, your ethnicity, and your religion doesn't matter. You should be equal under the law. And now Congress comes out and says, no, we condemn that. You're an anti-Semite if you take that position. This is what they're in the midst of. They are literally policing the language of activists as they also turn around and send more fighter jets and missiles to be used on carpet bombing children. I cannot explain to you in strong enough terms just how much absolute disdain and hatred I have for these people. I have disdain and I have hatred. Because they are going out of their way. But by the way, like I just said, they know that when college kids say from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, they know it's a call for liberation and human rights. They know it's not the same as when some Hamas militant says it in the context of saying we're going to do more October 7th and kill civilians. They know it's not the same. But the point is to smear. The point is to dismiss and push outside of the Overton window. Say, this is, you're not being civil enough. You're violating the norms. You're calling for violence. Now, by the way, how many times have we heard U.S. Congress people and also IDF officials and Israeli government officials say the most brazen, over-the-top genocidal things you've ever heard? I haven't seen a congressional condemnation of the people who said there are no civilians in Gaza. I haven't heard a congressional condemnation of the people who said Palestine should be wiped off the map. We've got 1,000 videos from pro-Palestine protesters in the halls of Congress pressing representatives where they just come out and say the most genocidal thing you've ever heard in your life. By the way, we have one of those protesters on Crystal Kyle and Friends this week. You should definitely check out Motaz. He is Palestinian. He's pressing these Congress people. It doesn't take much for them to immediately come out and say the most genocidal things you've ever heard in your life. And never do you hear a condemnation coming from Congress if the genocidal language, legit genocidal language, is on the pro-Israeli side. They act like it didn't happen, or they act like it was taken out of context, or they just totally ignore it and use utter indifference as their tool. By the way, that is the main tool, right? Utter indifference. Because how many times have we heard there is no such thing as a Palestinian civilian? There is no such thing. How many times have we heard, well, they could have overthrown Hamas, so they're guilty enough. How many times have we heard calls for complete and utter collective punishment? People backing the idea of a medieval siege where you starve 2.3 million people ostensibly to go after the 30,000 Hamas members. How many times have we heard all these things? We hear them on a daily basis. But here we are. They're going after pro-Palestine protesters, doing a liberation call. I can't deal with it. It's so obnoxious. And I think the thing that's most disturbing is just how unbelievably shattered the ethical and moral compass of our elected officials is. It's just, they wouldn't know morality if it dropped on their head like a fucking anvil. This is how they're spending their time. All right, so this has been a big story the past few days. We're going to talk about this. We'll also get to the response to it. You're not going to be surprised to hear that Republican senators have gone full bloodlust over this. Tom Cotton in particular. Again, we'll do that in a separate segment, but let's talk about this a little bit. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators shut down airport highways and key bridges in major U.S. cities. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators blocked roadways in Illinois, California, New York, and the Pacific Northwest on Monday, temporarily shutting down travel in some of the nation's most heavily used airports onto the Golden Gate and Brooklyn Bridges and on a busy West Coast highway. In Chicago, protesters linked arms and blocked lanes of Interstate 190 leading into O'Hare International Airport around 7 a.m. in a demonstration they said was part of a global economic blockade to free Palestine, according to Rifqa Falaneh, one of the organizers. Traffic in the San Francisco Bay Area was snarled for hours as demonstrators shut down all vehicle, pedestrian, and bike traffic on the Golden Gate Bridge and chained themselves to 55-gallon drums filled with cement across Interstate 880 in Oakland. Protesters marching into Brooklyn blocked Manhattan-bound traffic on the Brooklyn Bridge. In Eugene, Oregon, the protesters blocked Interstate 5, shutting down traffic on the major highway for about 45 minutes. Protesters say they chose O'Hare in part because it is one of the largest airports. Among other things, they've called for an immediate ceasefire in the war between Israel and Hamas. Anti-war protesters have demonstrated in Chicago nearly daily since October 7th. They go on here. Israeli war planes and ground troops have since conducted scorched earth campaign on the Gaza Strip. That's to put it kindly, if anything. Okay, so you get the gist of it. All of these, you know, very major points of traffic have been, were blocked. They were blocked. And you were getting some crazy images. You could see one here of the protesters blocking the Golden Gate Bridge. So there's a lot to say about this. And I'm curious, more importantly, what you guys think of it. Because you guys know my regular spiel when we talk about protesting. My general rule of thumb is that the best kind of protest is directly after the powerful who have the decision-making process here, right? So in other words, ideally what would happen is you go after the politicians, you know, and we've seen that, to be fair. A lot of these same pro-Palestine protesters have gone after Democratic politicians, they've gone after Republican politicians, they've gone after Joe Biden. They've interrupted their speeches. They make it so that their daily life is sort of a living hell, and it forces them to rethink, hey, should I really take the $1 million in AIPAC money and do their bidding, or will I lose my election if I do that? Because it seems like people are really fucking pissed off about the decisions I'm making. So in my opinion, those are like the ideal kinds of protest. I also would file under that same category the ones that have a direct, pragmatic, positive outcome. So for example, the one I always bring up is actually, it's like the old Chomsky idea of the ones who blocked a giant ship that was going to go to Israel that had all of the weapons and the ammo and everything with it. You had people basically try to stop this ship from getting to Israel. Now, I don't know if they fully succeeded. Maybe they were able to block it for a couple hours, and then eventually the ship was able to get out. But at the end of the day, that's 2 hours less time that they have weapons that they can then use to carpet bomb women and children, right? So in the hierarchy of protest, the top is the people with the power, the politicians, people in the military-industrial complex, people in the Pentagon, generals, you name it. And usually Code Pink is great at targeting them. Then equal to that would be the pragmatic outcome, like I just described, blocking the ship. There's only positive outcomes from that, even though technically that might be like the one where you are most violating the law, funny enough. But it's also the most moral, in my opinion. And underneath all of these things is like this kind of stuff, what we're seeing here. So here's why I'm of two minds about it. On the one hand, to steel man their case, you could always point to the historic atrocity we're witnessing to say almost anything, short of violence, almost anything is good. Because maybe they block traffic in all these major places, and let's say it happens more regularly. Now, it pisses off a lot of people, and they will be mad at the protesters, but the demands are super clear, and people in power, would it potentially, maybe, force the hand of people in power? Would it force the hand of somebody like Joe Biden to sort of wake up to the fact that you have a real grassroots uprising here, and they're willing to absolutely try to tank the U.S. economy in order to get a ceasefire, in order to save the lives of Palestinians? I think, like, to steel man their case, it's like, yes, we are messing stuff up. Yes, we are making life miserable. Yes, we are screwing people over. All that's true. And the only reason we're doing it is because there's a genocide and you need to stop arming and funding the genocide. Stop making us do something which we don't even want to do, but we feel like we have to do in order to put the spotlight and the focus on the genocide and get you to get your act together and stop sending Israel money, stop sending Israel weapons, you know, sanction them, condemn them at the UN, whatever it might be. right? So to steel man their case, it's like they'll look at you and say, I know what we're doing is fucked up. But what we're doing is trying to wake up the establishment, shake this administration out of its complacency to realize you have a real problem on your hand here. And what would happen if every single day all of these major airports were shut down or all these major bridges were shut down? You can't tell me that after like 3 weeks of that or 4 weeks of that, that they'd feel like, okay, we have to do something to try to stop this. Now, maybe it's the dumb approach and they're just like, just go crack some skulls, right? And that'll stop it. Maybe they'll take that approach. Or maybe they go, okay, maybe it's enough and we can kind of wrap it up with sending the money and the weapons to Israel, right? Even though I think that's kind of far-fetched, that's the Steelman argument for it. The argument against it is the one that, you know, everybody would make, which is these people that you're targeting, they're not the ones doing the genocide. These people that you're targeting, they're just regular people trying to put food on the table and pay the fucking light bill, right? These people that you're inconveniencing, maybe they even agree with you. But, you know, it could be something where, with actions like this, even though I think the protesters are right on the substance, is it something that could sort of turn people off and say, hey, man, these people are rabid, these people are crazy, these people are willing to fuck up everybody's life. Why should we trust their opinion on anything when they're clearly demonstrating bad judgment here? It's clearly misplaced anger at people who, you know, they didn't do anything. And I'm sure if you were in the line trying to get to the airport or whatever, you'd be really fucking pissed off too, right? But again, see, that's why I'm splitting. I guess to me, the big thing is it going to work, right? Is it going to work? And I genuinely believe that going after the powerful people who are making the decisions, it is forcing them to think about this. It is forcing them to consider, okay, the AIPAC money, the Israel lobby money helps me win elections. But are we now at a point where that's not the case, where it's actually detrimental to take the $1 million from AIPAC? Because in the process of doing that and espousing the positions they want, I'm losing like 70% of my base. It's kind of waking them up and making them rethink that. Again, blocking the ship is incredibly pragmatic and moral because you're just stopping the weapons from getting there as much as humanly possible. So on those fronts, I think the tactics just work. On this front, I think the jury's out, right? If there was a scenario where they did this time and time again, and then eventually you see immediately after it, hey, the U.S. decided to stop sending money and weapons to Israel, then maybe it's possible that that had an effect, right? But I think, unfortunately, what's more likely is it doesn't move the powerful, and it just makes people more pissed off at the pro-Palestine activists, which I don't want, but I know they don't want either, right? So I guess at the end of the day, my point is you have to be objective about the outcomes of the various approaches and determine whether or not it makes sense to keep doing it going forward. I will say that the thing that I struggle to get over, right, is like, it's almost like there's a genocide exception to any sort of concerns about the strategy not working, because it's almost like just throw everything against the wall and hope something sticks, hope something actually changes what's happening. And I think, to be fair to these protesters, that's their rationale, right? Is like, okay, let's say the year is 1940, and we just learned that about Hitler's Holocaust and what Nazi Germany is doing. And in this theoretical scenario, we are a major backer of the Nazi German government. And you have people blocking traffic, shutting down airports, desperately trying to get us to cut off our support to the Nazi government. Like, if you change the facts to something like that, even though it's inconveniencing people in the moment and they would probably hate it, regular people would probably hate it. It's also like, well, if this doesn't require the level of moral urgency to shut all this shit down, then literally nothing does, right? So I can't help but be sympathetic, even though I think it's not the best way to protest and to be an activist and to get change. I can't help but be sympathetic because it's like, we really are witnessing a historic atrocity. And in the midst of that historic atrocity, it's like, I don't believe in violence as a matter of principle. I only believe in defensive violence. But you want to try to do everything short of violence to get this to change. And, you know, if it does in any way, shape, or form help move the ball in the right direction, then what do you want me to say? And I know that's what these people, they wake up in the morning and what do they think about? The 17 babies who were carpet bombed yesterday and killed. The people who lost limbs because the IDF purposely shot at their leg. Right? The hospitals being bombed, the schools having planned demolitions. Like, you wake up thinking about that and know that we arm it and fund it, and it's like, well, holy shit, we have to do something to stop this. What can we do? And they're just desperate, coming up with, just, I don't know, do anything. Do anything to try to stop it. And so there's always, like, to me, even though I think there's a very clear and rigid hierarchy of the best kinds of protest, and this is certainly not at the top, it's hard to, like, just outright condemn it, because you know we're witnessing a historic moral atrocity right in front of our arms that the U.S. government is arming and backing and funding. And so it's, what you're seeing is desperation, right? What you're seeing is desperation from people. And I know that everybody who's being inconvenienced and it's ruining their day and it's ruining their trip or whatever, I know it's not their fault. They know it's not their fault. But, you know, we all should keep our eye on the ball here, which is stop the fucking genocide, man. So anyway, that's my breakdown of it. I'm curious what you guys think. Are you, let's make it simplistic. Put in the comment section. Are you hard against it? If you are hard against it, tell me exactly why in the comment section below. Are you hard for it? If you are, I mean, I think I know you're just, well, it's a genocide. We got to fucking stop it. Do anything, right? You'll probably say that. So put it below if you're a hard agree. Or if you're totally 50-50 and like I am, where you can sort of see both sides of the argument. Explain why below. I'm very curious to see what you guys think. My guess is there actually will be quite a bit of disagreement over this. But again, I think the part where all reasonable people can agree is what I just described, which is there is a rigid hierarchy of the best way to do these things. And at the very top is target the people with the power. Target the Pentagon, target the generals, target the military-industrial complex, target the politicians who are making the decisions, target the president. The other thing that's right at the top there is literal pragmatic real world stuff that like blocks the weapons from getting there, right? Those are all very, very, very top. And certainly this is not the best strategy. I think we could all agree on that, but I'm curious what you guys think. Post it below. All right, guys. So we just talked about the big, pro-Palestine protests, anti-genocide protests that, really, they got ambitious and they were shutting down major bridges and roads to major airports and things of that nature. And, you know, you guys tell me, again, I'm very curious what all you guys think about that, because it's certainly not the most likely to have positive outcomes. It's not at the top of the hierarchy in the way to protest that's most effective, in my opinion. But then again, as I always tell you guys, it's almost like there's a genocide exception clause where it's like anything short of violence, we got to stop arming and funding a genocide, right? Like, it's the most clearly, you know, moral imperative we've ever had about anything ever, right? So I'm curious what you guys think about that. But I know somebody who has very, very clear thoughts in the wrong direction, let's say. Guy by the name of Tom Cotton. Now, Tom Cotton is a loathsome cretin, to say the least. First of all, he looks like a fucking giraffe. He's got the longest neck and the nerdiest face you've ever seen. And he's a massive scumbag. So I remember the thing that sticks with me the most about Tom Cotton is that he was one of those guys who was, you know, far after the debate was settled about torture in this country, which it's kind of crazy we were even having a debate about torture during the War on Terror era, but we were. He was one of these guys who's like, let's keep torturing. I'm pro-torture. We need to do more torture. So that's what you need to know about this guy. He's also one of the worst neocons, right up there with Lindsey Graham and John Bolton and all those cretins who never met a war they didn't like. He doesn't, I'm Mr. Tough Guy, bro. Let's go bomb everybody, bro. So he comes out and is talking about these protesters shutting down like the Golden Gate Bridge, for example. And he says the following. I encourage people who get stuck behind the pro-Hamas mobs blocking traffic. Pro-Hamas mobs. See, this is why I can't take these people seriously. Because he's not even making the most basic, minimal effort to even be honest about the situation. Like, you can disagree with them while acknowledging their main point is to stop Israel from carpet bombing babies and starving Gaza to death. No, he calls them pro-Hamas. I encourage people who get stuck behind the pro-Hamas mobs blocking traffic, take matters into your own hands. It's time to put an end to this nonsense. So people looked at this And their first thought was, okay, well, he's calling for violence. Take matters into your own hands. What does that mean? What does that mean? You want to punch them? You want to assault them? You want to stab them? You want to shoot them? You want to throw them off the bridge? What do you mean? So then he comes out. Maybe he sees the backlash. I don't know. He doesn't strike me as one to like read responses. He says, so this is his correction. He edited it. I encourage people who get stuck behind the pro-Hamas mobs blocking traffic, take matters into your own hands to get them out of the way. It's time to put an end to this nonsense. So we added to get them out of the way. Tom, that still begs the question, what do you mean to get them out of the way? How do you want to get them out of the way? What does that mean? So of course, even with the correction, it's sort of like, it's still vaguely threatening, right? So now, in case you were still confused, which everybody should be, about what exactly he means, he goes on Fox News and he says the following.
I agree with you that you have to get to these criminals early. If something like this happened in Arkansas on a bridge there, let's just say I think there'd be a lot of very wet criminals that have been tossed overboard, not by law enforcement, but by the people whose road they're blocking. If they glued their hands to a car or the pavement, well, probably pretty painful to have their skin ripped off. But I think that's the way we'd handle in Arkansas. And I would encourage most people anywhere that get stuck behind criminals like this who are trying to block traffic to take matters in their own hands. There's only usually a few of them, and there's a lot of people being inconvenienced. It's time to put an end to this nonsense.
Let's just point out the sad irony. When he says it's time to put an end to this nonsense, he does not mean stop sending money and weapons to the people carpet bombing babies. He does not mean stop giving a green light to the people bombing hospitals and schools and mosques and churches and marketplaces. He doesn't mean that. We need to put a stop to this nonsense is the people who are protesting to try to get us to stop aiding and abetting a genocide. That's what he means. But look, he laid it out. If this were to happen in Arkansas, what would we do? There'd be a lot of wet people. They'd be thrown off the bridge. Okay, Tom, you do realize that if somebody's thrown off the Golden Gate Bridge, that's a death sentence. In fact, unfortunately, a lot of people who commit suicide will go to, you know, like the top of the George Washington Bridge or whatever bridge and jump off of it. Because, you know, the human body can't, that sort of impact against water from that height is like landing on cement, right? So, okay, if I'm being kind, maybe he didn't know that that would lead to death, right? He's just, they'd be wet. And then when he says, you know, ripping their skin off, he couches that in, well, if they glue their hands to the pavement or glue their hands to the car, just rip their skin off. Because I guess drive away really fast or what? Run over them if their hands are on the pavement. What are we doing here? Guys, remember when, what was it? It was during, I think, the George Floyd protests and riots. And Tom Cotton wrote an article for the New York Times where he said, just declare martial law, send in the military, crack skulls. I need you to think about what that means. I need you to think about that. Were there some people who were protesting who actually crossed the line and became rioters? Of course, there were people who rioted. And those people broke laws and they will be held accountable and they have been held accountable. And that's just the way it works. You're allowed to peacefully protest. You are not allowed to start burning down a Walgreens or a small business, right? That's obvious. Nobody's against that, right? Nobody's against holding those people accountable and responsible for their actions. But when he says, send in the military, when he says, you know, do martial law, what that means is we're going to treat them all the same. The 90% peaceful protesters, they're going to be held accountable in the same way the rioters are because we're just going to shut the whole thing down. And by the way, that's what our generals were saying when Trump was trying to invoke the Insurrection Act, which is what Tom Cotton supported, and just send the U.S. military into our own streets. Our own generals were like, this is not what our military is for. Our military is not to police the streets of the United States of America to crack down on people who are exercising their First Amendment rights in the majority of cases of people who are out there on the street. But that's his belief. His belief is, I don't care. They're all guilty. Shut it all down. Send in the military. Lock them all up. Kick them all out. No more First Amendment. No more free speech rights. No more right to protest. No, I think this is nonsense because I don't agree with what they're calling for. So authoritarianism. Let's do that. All in authoritarianism. And now you get it here, too. Now you get it here, too. Again, you know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of the whole debate around the Houthis. Because the Houthis started seizing ships and, you know, stopping trade with Israel. And in some instances, they would get the wrong ship, and that was a problem. But as a general rule, they were saying, we are trying to stop trade in and out of Israel because we want to stop them from doing the genocide. And they were very clear. They were very clear. Hey, if they stop, we stop. If they stop, we stop. They stop bombing women and children. If they stop destroying Gaza, we will stop seizing the ships. And everybody decided to act professionally stupid. Everybody with any position of power. Gosh, what should we do? Let's go bomb the Houthis. Let's go start another war. Let's use our firepower against their firepower. It's hard to figure out what do they want? How do we get them to stop doing this? Nobody in the room brought up the obvious. Okay, have Israel stop carpet bombing Gaza and they will stop. When there was a brief ceasefire, they stopped. And this is the same thing. It's like, you're so mad at these protesters doing this thing that they're doing. It's so bad. It's so evil. How do we get them to stop? Throw them off the bridge, rip off their skin, physically assault them, move them out of the way. Or you could have the U.S. stop arming and funding Israel. Because again, that's the whole point here. But what he wants is to have his cake and eat it too. He wants to arm and fund the genocide. He wants to support the genocide. He's in favor of that. And he also wants to crack skulls and go after protesters. He has a track record of wanting to do that. So this is who this guy is, man. Now look, I understand. That's actually, in my opinion, it's actually a very complicated discussion about the strategy and the tactics being used here. I did a whole separate segment on that. You guys can watch it. So I don't think there's an easy answer about whether or not this is the right way to go. To me, you guys know I want to target the politicians. I want to target the military-industrial complex. I want to target the generals. I want to target the president. I want to block the ships or the planes that are about to go with the weapons to Israel. That's where I think all of our focus should be. I love the harassing of Congress members in Congress to try to... They can't go anywhere peacefully because they're getting shamed and it's impacting them. And they feel, is it really worth it to take the AIPAC money and do their bidding? Or should I listen to the constituents who are clearly pissed off about this? That's the best way to do it. This is not my favorite way of protesting. But having said that, there's no doubt why these people are doing this and what the point is and what their intentions are and where their heart is on this. And instead of acknowledging that, digesting it, reacting in a rational, logical way, adjusting course, it's let's keep arming and funding the genocide and also let's crack some skulls with some protesters. Okay, look, final point is this. He is more outraged at protesters blocking traffic than he is at 15,000 children who were murdered by Israel on purpose. That about says it all. All right, guys, so this here is a bombshell story. It came out a couple days ago, and it's being talked about a lot, but I don't think it's possible to talk about this story enough. I mean, this is really next-level stuff here. So Jeremy Scahill says, leaked New York Times Gaza memo tells journalists to avoid words genocide, ethnic cleansing, and occupied territory. They're telling their own journalists and reporters, you're not allowed to use these words. Okay, that's called censorship. That's also called journalistic malpractice, because you're telling them, you're not allowed to be honest. You're not allowed to correctly ascribe labels. That's what this is. So Ryan Grimm and Jeremy Scahill did the reporting for The Intercept here. The New York Times instructed journalists covering Israel's war on the Gaza Strip to restrict the use of terms genocide and ethnic cleansing and avoid using the phrase occupied territory when describing Palestinian land, according to a copy of an internal memo obtained by The Intercept. Look, there's a problem here. This is literally, legally, the correct description, occupied territory. It is internationally acknowledged as occupied territory. And they're blocked. They're blocked from using it. This is wild. This is wild. So basically, there's a memo down from the top of the New York Times. You have to lie on behalf of Israel. The memo also instructs reporters not to use the word Palestine except in very rare cases and to steer clear of the term refugee camps to describe areas of Gaza historically settled by displaced Palestinians expelled from other parts of Palestine during previous Israeli-Arab wars. So again, yet another war on objective reality here, because these are refugee camps. My guess is where this stems from is the number of times Israel bombed refugee camps. Remember when they bombed, killed over 100 people in a refugee camp? It may have even been over 200. By their own admission, to get one Hamas member. My guess is that with the backlash from that, where everybody's like, oh my God, you psychos are bombing refugee camps? That's when the New York Times kicked it into gear. Let's not even use the term refugee camp. Because, you know, the problem is the description, not the actual thing that happened. This is incredible. The areas are recognized by the UN as refugee camps and house hundreds of thousands of registered refugees. The memo written by the Times Standards editor Susan Wessling, international editor Philip Pan, and their deputies, quote, offers guidance about some terms and other issues we have grappled with since the start of the conflict in October. Even that is incredibly biased. Since the start of the conflict in October. The start was October? Do we need to tell you about Operation Protective Edge in 2014, where Israel killed over 80% civilians? Do we need to go all the way back to 1948 and the Nakba? Do we need to discuss 1967? The start? Guys, we know the Abraham Accords and moving the embassy to Jerusalem, those things were key catalysts which led to October 7th. The whole point of U.S. policy vis-a-vis Palestine was a middle finger to say, we're going to go around you. You don't exist. We don't care about you. We're moving the embassy to Jerusalem and spitting in your eye, and we're trying to normalize relations with Israel and other Arab nations. And again, that's a way to spit in your eye and say your concerns will never be dealt with. Who cares about your rights? And that was the straw that broke the camel's back, which led to October 7th, or one of the straws that broke the camel's back. And they say, since the start of the conflict on October 7th, the start? While the document is presented as an outline for maintaining objective journalistic principles, oh my God, oh, I'm going to have an aneurysm. In reporting on the Gaza War, several Time staffers told The Intercept that some of its contents show evidence of the paper's deference to Israeli narratives. You don't say, quote, I think it's the kind of thing that looks professional and logical if you have no knowledge of the historical context of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, said a Times newsroom source, who requested anonymity for fear of reprisal of the Gaza memo. Quote, but if you do know, it will be clear how apologetic it is to Israel. First distributed to Times journalists in November, the guidance, which collected and expanded on past style directives about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, has been regularly updated over the ensuing months. It presents an internal window into the thinking of Times International editors as they have faced upheaval within the newsroom surrounding the paper's Gaza War coverage. Quote, issuing guidance like this to ensure accuracy, consistency, and nuance in how we cover the news is standard practice, said Charlie Statlander, a Times spokesperson. Across all our reporting, including complex events like this, we take care to ensure our language choices are sensitive, current, and clear to our audience. Your standards are a war on the truth. Don't nuance troll us. They have the nerve to say we're doing this for accuracy's sake. No, if you were doing this for accuracy's sake, you would say you have to use the words occupied territory. You have to use the words ethnic cleansing and genocide. At this point, it is absolutely inescapable that that's what's going on. They have the nerve to spit in our eye and say, we're doing this because we're trying to be better. No, you're doing this because you're fucking biased. You're doing this because you're waging a war on the truth on behalf of the Israeli government. They continue here. Issues over style guidance have been among a bevy of internal rifts at the Times over its Gaza coverage. In other words, there are some people in the New York Times that see this for what it is. A naked attempt to lie in favor of the Israeli narrative. And there are some people there with integrity who are like, are you kidding me? In January, The Intercept reported on disputes in the Times newsroom over issues with an investigative story on systemic sexual violence on October 7th. The leak gave rise to a highly unusual internal probe. The company faced harsh criticism for allegedly targeting Times workers of Middle East and North African descent, which Times brass denied. On Monday, executive editor Joe Kahn told staff that the leak investigation has been concluded unsuccessfully. So you guys remember that. A lot of the most hyperbolic stories in the wake of October 7th totally fell apart. You know, 40 beheaded babies, baby in an oven, systemic sexual assault by Hamas. All of these things completely and utterly fell apart. Now, by the way, that's not to say that Hamas didn't commit atrocities. Of course they did. But there were over-the-top, brazen lies that the Times backed up to try to build the narrative of these are vicious monsters who are so beyond the pale and so beyond any sort of reason or logic or rationality or morality that anything that's done in response is acceptable. They helped build the narrative that led to a genocide and an ethnic cleansing. Because, oh, if you're urging restraint, oh, if you're urging more caution, well, I guess you're in favor of a baby in an oven. I guess you're in favor of 40 beheaded babies. There was a big breakdown of the story on the systemic sexual assault. One of the families that was used in that piece came out and said, that's not what we told you. We didn't tell you that. You're weaving your own narrative over here. That's not true. And this goes hand in hand with, remember the analysis, I think it was The Intercept that did it, that showed the type of language being used when it's violence against Israelis versus violence against Palestinians. When it's violence against Israelis, it's terrorism, massacre, slaughter. They use words like horrific. When it's violence against Palestinians, it's passive language. There was a blast. A blast occurred. Well, blast? Who did the blast? I guess the blast better stop that. They don't assign agency and intent when it's Palestinian civilians being killed. It's passive language. It's neutral language. All the emotive language is used for Israelis. And now we know. Guys, this is how comical it's gotten. This is how comical it's gotten. Avoid words like genocide, ethnic cleansing, and occupied territory. Well, let me ask you a question. If we got to 200,000 Palestinians dead, 170,000 of them civilians, then would you be okay with calling it genocide? I mean, Israel announced, we want to take the people of Gaza and push them through the Rafah border to set up a tent city in the Sinai Desert. That's what we want to do. That is textbook ethnic cleansing. They announced it, and you're not allowed to call a spade? So would you ever, under any circumstance, be able to use that word? We all know the answer. The answer is no. The answer is no. If you can't say occupied territory when it is very clearly occupied territory in the West Bank, if you can't do that, what are we doing here? I want to reiterate, it's a war on the truth. It's a war on the truth in favor of the Israeli narrative. They said you're not allowed to use the word Palestine. Again, tell me how that's not biased. I'd love to know what were the very rare instances they could use it. Here's the main takeaway. Paper of record, my ass cheeks. There's this myth that goes around. This idea that the establishment, legacy, traditional, institutional media outlets, like they're just more serious. They're more serious. They're more objective. They care more about the truth. It's just not true. The establishment and the legacy media, they have their own sacred cows and pieties and their own narrative that they try to adhere to come hell or high water. And you've never seen a more clear example than what you're seeing here. If you say you can't use terms that very obviously and clearly apply, there's no other thing to call that, but you have a policy of lying. Your policy is to lie. Your policy is to gaslight. How pathetic is it when, like, a YouTube show like mine is more truthful than the fucking New York Times? And by the way, they're doing it to themselves, right? They're destroying their own credibility. That's what this is. Because here's the thing. There's a right-wing version of skepticism of mainstream media that functionally is just wrong. Why? Because their take is, we don't like mainstream media, but we believe every single thing Donald Trump says. It's like, well, no, he's fucking lying to you too, and honestly, probably lying to you even more, right? But like, they made their bed, and they're now going to sleep in it. These are self-inflicted wounds. There's a reason why. You look at the polls, and trust in media is always at a historic low the more time goes by. People see through your bullshit. And by the way, final point. This all links in, doesn't it? To Remember that war on TikTok that they're doing where they're trying to ban TikTok? Now, by the way, they're trying to slip that provision into a bill on foreign aid to Ukraine and Israel. They're trying to slip the TikTok ban in there. So they're trying to ban TikTok because there's a lot of pro-Palestine stuff on TikTok. You have Threads and Instagram and Facebook are now burying all political content. And so they're trying to steer you in the direction of only go to the traditional media outlets, the legacy media outlets, whether it's in print or on TV, and take their word for it. And all the other alternate sources, it's like they try to clamp down on it a little, right? And here we are. I don't know why anybody should trust you about anything after this memo comes out. They shouldn't trust you about anything. You are gagging your journalists. You are censoring your own journalists. You are waging a war on the truth to soften the image of what's happening in Gaza to be more favorable to the Israeli government. It's beyond pathetic. All right, guys. So one of my favorite segments here. We love it when Cenk Uygur goes on Piers Morgan because there's always fireworks and except the last time Rabbi Shmuley was discussing butt plugs, and that was a little uncomfortable. I think it was uncomfortable for Cenk too. He made that very clear. But now he went on the show. He's with, remember Joe Walsh? He was a Republican congressman during the Tea Party era, and he used to be like a bomb thrower on the far right, and now all of a sudden he's like, I don't know. He's like an, I don't know if he's an anti-Trump Republican still, or if he's now made the switch to like he's a resistance liberal. It's kind of hard to tell just from this segment, but he's with that guy, but that guy's not really involved in this back and forth. He's with this this neocon Emily Schrader, and they're gonna debate what's happening with Iran right now. So we all know the backstory. Israel attacked the Iranian consulate in Syria. That's an act of aggression. That's an act of war. It's completely illegal. It's not a thing that you can just do and get away with. But they're Israel, so, and they're unhinged, so they think they can. So they do that, and then Iran retaliates with what was basically like a virtue signal attack. They gave them ample warning hours and hours in advance. Almost all the missiles got shot out of the sky. And it was really a way of saying, like, hey, we have to respond to save face, but also we don't want a wider war, so here's your warning. Okay. So now, with the table set, Piers Morgan is going to ask Cenk a question about Iran, the neocon is going to come in and warmonger, and the rest is history.
The whole regional issues are very complex, and we have, of course, at the same time, the situation in Gaza. But Cenk, when you see what Iran did to Israel, what do you think Israel's response should be?
Their response should be nothing. They should leave well enough alone. Joe Biden, with a rare victory here in being right about the situation, de-escalate right now. Israel obviously started this. And by that, I don't mean we can get into, oh, my God, their proxies and the Hamas, but then the occupation, and we can go all the way back to 1948. What I mean specifically is they attack Iran basically on its home soil by attacking the consulate, killing their top general, etc. It was an act of provocation. It was meant to get Iran to retaliate. Netanyahu, who has been dying for a war with Iran for about two decades now, he definitely started this. It left Iran absolutely no choice but to respond. And they responded in a way that basically showed their hand, which was, we don't want a war. They gave 72-hour notice. It took the drones several hours to get there. If Iran wanted to do damage inside Israel, it would not have done this type of attack at all. This was Iran basically saying, look, we have to appease our domestic audience here and tell them, oh, we were tough and struck Israel back. But they knew they were going to get no casualties. So we had a tit for tat. We should leave it alone right now. If Israel goes back and hits Iran again, then there's going to be no end to this. Then Iran is going to have to respond, and this time it's going to be real. And people are going to die in Israel. It's a terrible, disastrous idea. They should definitely stop right now.
Yeah, I mostly agree with that. My only point of disagreement is on Biden, where he says, you know, Biden's right for once, where he's urging de-escalation. Look, the problem with that is I view it the same as his, like, finger wagging and PR campaign on the issue of Gaza, where he's like, hey, don't kill so many civilians. Here's more money and more weapons. Go ahead, do what you want. But I'm against you doing what you want, but go ahead and do what you want. It's the same thing on this, right? He says, oh, yeah, we're urging restraint and de-escalation, and we're allegedly telling Israel, you know, if you attack, you're on your own. We're not going to help you if Iran attacks back. Because then there's also an equal number of moments where they say the opposite. One of the White House spokespeople the other day said, Israel's a sovereign country. They're going to do what they want, and we can't control that. And if you're saying that, then that's effectively a green light for Israel to retaliate, right? And then we've also heard that we have an ironclad commitment to Israel's security. They answered like that in the context of, hey, will you help Israel if they get into a bigger war with Iran. So, unfortunately, I don't believe Joe Biden when he says restraint, de-escalation, because he has the ability to force that on Israel, but I don't think he's going to do that. So that's my biggest disagreement. Everything else he says there is completely right. Israel absolutely started this. You can't be a cry bully and punch somebody in the face, and then when they retaliate, go, how dare you? Now I'm going to escalate even more. But the fact of the matter is, as Cenk points out, Netanyahu has always wanted this war. We've known going back to the George W. Bush administration. He wanted it then. He wanted it under Barack Obama. He wanted it under Donald Trump. And now he wants it under Joe Biden. It's a matter of historical record. There's been 1,000 pieces of evidence that point in this direction, that he wants that war with Iran.
Okay, Emily Schrader, I can see you, I would say, not entirely agreeing with what you've just heard.
Yes, I strongly disagree, as you can imagine. I think the entire premise of asking Israel to exercise restraint rather than deterrence is a fundamental part of the problem here. I mean, as the Crown Prince mentioned, the Islamic Republic has been doing this for many, many years. It's a fundamental premise of the regime since 1979. They have been sworn to Israel's destruction. They have been sworn to America's destruction. This is a fundamental value of the Islamic Republic. And not only that, but I find it very interesting what Cenk is saying right now, because the majority of the Iranian people, both inside and outside of Iran, disagree with him. In fact, there are thousands and thousands of Iranians who wish that Israel will assist the people of Iran in bringing down this regime. We are not going to see a better future in the Middle East for the Arab Muslims, for the Iranians, or for the Israelis in the Middle East until there is regime change in Iran. And to say that Israel started this is preposterous. It's not Israel that has a countdown to the destruction of Israel in the center of their largest city. That's Iran. It's Iran who has made hating Israel a fundamental premise of the regime, an obsessive hatred, an obsessive irrational hatred, that they have taken money from the people of Iran and poured hundreds of millions of dollars into terrorist proxy organizations on the borders of Israel in order to ultimately destruct and destroy the state of Israel.
So, in other words, Iran is so unhinged and they want to destroy everybody and they're the worst and they're nefarious and they're evil. Do you have any thoughts on the current genocide that Israel is carrying out against Palestinians in Gaza? Do you have any thoughts on the increasing onslaught from illegal Israeli settlers in the West Bank against Palestinians? No, no thoughts on that. Do you have any thoughts on the conferences that are being held about resettling Gaza and ethnically cleansing the Palestinians in Gaza? Do you have any thoughts on that? Do you have any thoughts on people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich in top positions of power in the Israeli government who openly talk about expanding and creating a greater Israel, which would include parts of Lebanon and Egypt and Jordan? So in other words, the idea is she's harping away, Iran is expansionist! And they hate everybody around them when Israel is expansionist and they hate everybody around them. Jesus Christ, I hate this woman so much already.
They have taken money from the people of Iran and poured hundreds of millions of dollars into terrorist proxy organizations on the borders of Israel in order to ultimately destruct and destroy the state of Israel. I also want to add one more thing about the consulate that's important to note, that it was not, in fact, a consulate. It was an annex of the consulate. And even if it was a consulate, under international law, it is permissible to strike when it's being used as a military headquarters to plan and conduct terrorist operations. Israel is in a...
Okay, and Israel lied about that. They lied about that, like they do all the fucking time. This is what they said about Soleimani when the U.S. took out Soleimani.
Well, we were doing it, but he was plotting an attack against the U.S.
He was on the ground fighting ISIS at that time. They just lie.
Sure, we attacked your consulate, which is like attacking on your home soil, but we got the replacement for Soleimani, a guy
who wasn't in the midst of attacking you. There was no direct threat. They weren't planning anything. By the way, the new lie is, that guy helped plan October 7th. No, he didn't. We have ironclad intelligence, which showed that Iran was pissed after October 7th, because they were like, what the fuck? Now, we're going to get blamed. They're going to say, since you're our proxy, you're doing it on behalf of us. This is a lie, 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 lie.
We're in a state of war with a proxy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hamas, and that is what that commander who was killed in that strike was doing there. So this is a legitimate target,
okay,
even though Israel hasn't officially claimed responsibility.
Okay, I'm going to bring Joe in a moment. I just want to get, Cenk, you were laughing at one stage there. What were you laughing at?
Yeah, I mean, look, a lot of absurd things were said there. Like any mention of the Crown Prince. I mean, the guy's the son of a former dictator of Iran. He has zero credibility with the Iranian people. Look, the Iranian regime is...
That's absolutely
is a
false.
Disaster.
He is the most, he is the most popular figure of any Iranians. Are you Iranian? Ask the Iranians yourself.
Okay,
it's very, very clear.
Oh, please.
Well, there are some
please,
people who don't support him.
Back.
To be fair, it is true that there are some people, even in Iran, who want to get the son of the crown prince back and go back to like a secular dictator, right? That was the Shah. He was like a secular dictator. But he's still a dictator, right? So like, there's more options on the menu than just Islamic theocratic dictator and secular dictator, right? And that's kind of Cenk's point. Okay, let's keep going.
He is the most popular figure of any Iranians. Are you Iranian? Ask the Iranians yourself. Okay, it's very, very clear.
Oh, please,
while there are some people who don't support him, the vast majority of them do support the Shah.
Is she just going to talk over me? Because we can keep doing this all day long. Let me answer the question. So, first of all, the idea that they want their dictator back is hilarious. Second of all, but the thing that I laughed out loud at is she's like, oh, the Iranian people want Israel to bomb them. Do they? That's the most preposterous thing I have ever heard in my life.
I said the Iranian people want... It's actually not. There are multiple...
She doesn't even attack and say, that's not actually what I meant. I didn't mean that the Iranian people want Israel to bomb them. She's like, that's not absurd. The Iranian people do want Israel to bomb them. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Pick another field. This is not for you.
That show that. I personally think it's crazy.
Multiple polls that show that they want to be bombed by Israel?
There have been... that they support...
I would love to see who conducted those polls. What the phrasing of the question was. That is the most obvious push poll of all time, if it even exists, right? What a ridiculous thing to say. Guys, any people of any country, stop and think about this for a second. If you get bombed by another country, nothing will make you rally around the flag more. Literally nothing. The best evidence of this, George W. Bush, in the wake of 9/11, had like a 90% approval rating. Why? The rally around the flag effect. If you get attacked, everybody circles the wagon, and all of a sudden, we're all Iranians now, right? Everybody on our team is the good guys. That's how the psychology of this works. God, she's so dumb.
That they support Israeli strikes. That they support Israeli strikes on regime, IRGC, and regime sites exclusively. On IRGC sites. Yes, the majority of the Iranian people support regime change. The majority of the Iranian people support regime change.
But now she's playing loose. Because, like, the details matter, don't they? It's true. Like, okay, the population of Iran is relatively young. And they're definitely more secular. Definitely more democratic than the old guard theocratic Revolutionary Guard group and the Grand Ayatollah. Like, it's true that the Iranian people don't want this government. They definitely want a different government. But don't you think the specifics matter? If that new government comes about because Israel wages an all-out war against Iran, I think that's like one of the only things that could make them then turn around and say, you know what? What we had before was better. You know, how many people are going to be dead as a result of it? How many people are going to go starving as a result of it? How many people are going to be displaced as a result of it? The details of the so-called regime change absolutely matter. It's not like, well, get rid of any old thing will do. Just get rid of the Ayatollahs. Like, what an absurd thing.
On IRGC sites. Yes, the majority of the Iranian people support regime change. The majority of the Iranian people support regime change. I find it disgraceful that you are laughing at the suffering.
Come on, I can't. I hate people like this. You're in the middle of a debate. It's a political debate. You show up to debate, and then this is disgraceful. How dare you react like that? He's reacting like that because you said one of the dumbest fucking things anybody's ever said on planet Earth. Okay? You want to attack the substance, or you want to do the my feelings? I'm offended. Disgraceful.
Of 80
I'm laughing in your face.
Live under an Islamist dictatorship. There are women who are being dragged away by the morality police. As the Crown Prince mentioned, there is a second front of this war, and it is against the Iranian people internally. Is that funny to you?
Oh my God. So she's so dishonest. Holy shit. Pro tip to anybody doing a debate, don't do this. Do not do this.
Is she just going to talk 90% of the time? Is she just going to talk 90% of the time?
I can do that too.
Is that funny to you?
Let me just respond real quick.
Do you find it funny that women, that Iranians are being oppressed?
Can I respond? All right, whatever.
Will you answer this? Here, let me say another 5 sentences while I say, will you answer this? But I'm going to keep talking after I ask you, will you answer this?
We're not going to. All right. So, listen, the Iranian regime is terrible. I don't want Muslim fundamentalists in charge of Iran, and the people of Iran don't want Muslim fundamentalists in charge of Iran. So saying that they're against the regime is obvious. That's not the point. The question is, what are you going to do about it? If you said, hey, there's an internal revolution, and they're disgusted by the way that the Iranian regime is treating women or its own citizens and not giving them freedom, I totally agree. But if you claim that they want Israel to bomb Iran in order to effectuate regime change, You sound, it's not even, you don't even sound like a lunatic. You sound like you're a comic or something. You're trying to make a joke. That's why I'm laughing. No, the Iranian people do not want to be bombed.
Let me bring in Joe. Let me bring in Joe.
But furthermore.
All right, let me bring in Joe. Joe's been waiting very patiently. Joe, here's my question for you about this. Yeah. I'm not a conspiracy theorist by nature, but let me just put an idea out there about what may be really going on here. It doesn't seem to me to be a coincidence that October the 7th happened when it did, or that Iran chooses this moment to attack Israel directly, and that it may all be linked to the Abraham Accords, to the normalization of relations between Israel and many of the Middle Eastern countries, to the fact that Saudi Arabia was on the verge of joining that normalization of relations with Israel, and that for Iran, this is the ultimate nightmare, and that through their proxy tentacles in Gaza and Hamas, they facilitated what happened on October the 7th.
Why is he ignoring the ironclad intelligence that we have? That it was clear, they came out and said Iran was pissed about October 7th. They were pissed because they know we're going to get blamed, and then they might come attack us. I don't know why he's ignoring that. The Palestinians on their own have agency. And yes, it was the Abraham Accords. Yes, it was the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem. That pissed them the fuck off, because the whole world was giving them the middle finger and spitting in their eye. They were reminding people, we're here. We're still here. I don't know why I'm still listening to this, but I just want to give it a little more.
And maybe deliberately provoke Israel into what they would see as an overreaction, which would then lose global support. And it may be that what they've done...
It was Israel that provoked Iran. Israel attacked Iran first with the bombing of the consulate. What? Okay, I don't... Piers.
Well, this missile strike directly into Israel is part of the same process, deliberately goading Israel into potentially overreact.
Deliberately goading Israel. You know who's doing all the goading? It is Israel. This is unbelievable.
Which may ultimately play into Iran's hands.
Pierce, I think you are spot on, my friend. Look, it's silly to engage in who started this first. Let's not do that. We all three of us agree that Iran's ruling regime is an evil regime. The Iranian people...
So is the Israeli regime. They are outright evil.
...to live in freedom. Pierce, you're exactly right. Look, the answer is the only way we get to peace in this region is when Israel can partner with the moderate Arab countries and isolate Iran's proxies and all the other Islamists, not Muslims, Islamists who want to destroy Israel. Pierce, which is why I agree with Cenk on what Israel should do to what happened over the weekend. Do nothing.
You know, it was a flawless victory for Cenk in his debate with this neocon freak, because even this guy who used to be a super far-right Republican, a Tea Party guy, and normally, again, I know he's anti-Trump, but usually he's like, I'm an anti-Trump conservative, and I have conservative opinions. And he comes out, and he's like, no, Cenk's right. They shouldn't do anything. It is very rare in this business that in a real-time debate, you actually, like, change somebody's mind. But because this woman is so unhinged, Joe Walsh was like, yeah, I think Cenk's right. Israel shouldn't do anything. Oh, yes. That's amazing. All right, y'all, this story right here is absolutely gigantic, and it's getting nowhere near enough coverage. This is a very straightforward and clear example of the Supreme Court taking an absolute sledgehammer to the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Now, by the way, as we go through this, I need you to stop and reflect on the fact that for the past 5 years or so, conservatives have just absolutely bathed in the notion that we're the free speech people. We believe in free speech. You know, we'll go to the mat for that opinion. It's the left who are censorious and authoritarian, and they want to shut people down, and they want to cancel people, and they want to ban people. And we are the last bastions of free speech and free protest. This is what they said. But as we all know, they didn't mean it. They turned on a dime the second the politics changed. And the second it was about banning people they don't like, all of a sudden they're the censorious, petty little authoritarians who are canceling people. Case in point, George Floyd. In the wake of George Floyd, there were riots, yes, but there were also protests. And a lot of these people said, yeah, do the Insurrection Act, good, do martial law, send in the military, crack down on all these protesters, even though 90% of them are perfectly peaceful, shut them down. We don't like them. Laws in Florida saying, hey, if you happen to run over a protester who's blocking the road, is it really your fault? You remember that law? I remember that law. Well, now we have another example of it here. This is wild. The Supreme Court effectively abolishes the right to mass protest in three U.S. states. It's no longer safe to organize a protest in Louisiana, Mississippi, or Texas. So some of the most conservative places in the country. Let's dive in here. The Supreme Court announced on Monday that it will not hear McKesson versus Doe. The decision not to hear McKesson leaves in place a lower court decision that effectively eliminated the right to organize a mass protest in the states of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas. Under that lower court decision, a protest organizer faces potentially ruinous financial consequences if a single attendee at a mass protest commits an illegal act. So you organize a big protest with 1,000 people, one of those people commits a crime, your ass is on the line. This is unbelievable. It is possible that this outcome will be temporary. The court did not embrace the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit's decision attacking the First Amendment right to protest, but it did not reverse it either. That means that, at least for now, the Fifth Circuit's, I don't know why that's so hard to say, decision is the law in much of the American South. For the past several years, the Fifth Circuit has engaged in a crusade against DeRay McKesson, a prominent figure within the Black Lives Matter movement who organized a protest near a Baton Rouge police station in 2016. The facts of the McKesson case are unfortunately quite tragic. McKesson helped organize the Baton Rouge protest following the fatal police shooting of Alton Sterling. I remember that. During the protest, an unknown individual threw a rock or a similar object at a police officer. The plaintiff in the McKesson case, who is identified only as Officer John Doe. Sadly, the officer was struck in the face and, according to one court, suffered injuries to his teeth, jaw, brain, and head. Everyone agrees that this rock was not thrown by McKesson, however, and the Supreme Court held in NAACP versus Claiborne Hardware that protest leaders cannot be held liable for the violent actions of a protest participant, absent unusual circumstances that are not present in the McKesson case, such as if McKesson had authorized, directed, or ratified the decision to throw the rock. Indeed, as Justice Sonia Sotomayor points out in a brief opinion accompanying the court's decision not to hear McKesson, the court recently reaffirmed the strong First Amendment protections enjoyed by people like McKesson in Counterman versus Colorado. That decision held that the First Amendment precludes punishment for inciting violent action unless the speaker's words were intended, not just likely, to produce imminent disorder. The reason Claiborne protects protest organizers should be obvious. No one who organizes a mass event attended by thousands of people can possibly control the actions of all those attendees, regardless of whether the event is a political protest, a musical concert, or the Super Bowl. So if protest organizers can be sanctioned for the illegal action of any protest attendee, no one in their right mind would ever organize a political protest again. Indeed, as Fifth Circuit Judge Don Willett, who dissented from his court's McKesson decision, warned in one of his dissents, his court's decision would make protest organizers liable for the unlawful acts of counter-protesters and agitators. So under the Fifth Circuit Court's rule, a Ku Klux Klanman could sabotage the Black Lives Matter movement simply by showing up at its protest and throwing stones. So this is the old idea of agent provocateurs, right? You have a protest, it's nominally for whatever issue, and then you have people who are on the opposite side of that issue who infiltrate the protest and pretend like they agree, and then they do something bad, and who gets blamed? The people who are pushing for that issue, right? Oh my God, you're all to blame. Why? Because a KKK member entered a Black Lives Matter rally and committed a crime, and now, under this ruling, whoever organized the protest is liable. By the way, this isn't just an assault on the First Amendment and free protest, which it is. It's also an assault on personal agency and responsibility. Because you know who should go to prison for throwing a rock at somebody and knocking their fucking teeth out? The person who threw the rock. They're the ones who should be held legally responsible. And by the way, that is a crime. I don't know anybody who would say that's not a crime. Lock that motherfucker up. No problem whatsoever. Have a trial, give them their day in court, and then boom, lock them up. Instead now, this is collective punishment. All of you involved in the protest, even if you were perfectly peaceful, you're now responsible. Most importantly, the person who organized it is responsible. Even if that person comes out and says, do not do any violence. Doesn't matter. You're now responsible. Where are all the free speech warriors? Where are all they? Where are all the First Amendment crusaders? Where's Ben Shapiro? Where's Dave Rubin? I'm waiting. They won't say dick about this. And you know why, and I know why. Because DeRay McKesson is a Black Lives Matter guy. DeRay McKesson is nominally on the liberal side or the left of the political spectrum. They don't agree with him. They don't agree with Black Lives Matter. Since their politics are different, now all of a sudden the principle is out the window. It's gone. Nowhere to be found. By the way, careful what you wish for, because the exact same thing could happen on the conservative side, right? You could take, some anti-masking protest during COVID. You could have some left-winger who supports masking infiltrate the anti-masking protest and start throwing rocks and hitting people. And by the ruling of this court, whoever organized that right-wing protest would be held responsible. This is absolutely disastrous, man. This is absolutely disastrous. So because the Supreme Court rejected this case, the lower court ruling holds, and the lower court ruling is whoever organized it is responsible, even if they didn't do any violence themselves, even if they are openly against violence, even if they announced don't do violence, sorry, you're responsible. Which again, this has a massive chilling effect. Now you would be a psycho to organize a protest about anything. Because all it takes is one person to be a bad apple. And then the leader is responsible, which by extension means everybody there is responsible. There's just going to be no more people having protests anymore. An all-out war on the First Amendment, an all-out war on free protest, an absolutely preposterous decision, and yet again, another day, another one of our rights slowly but surely going away. And this time, it's not even so slow. We talked about it the other day with the extension of the illegal, warrantless FISA spying. Extended for 2 more years. Protection from unreasonable search and seizure? Gonzo. That's been gone since the Patriot Act days. Free speech, free protest? Gonzo. You got people like Tom Cotton and Donald Trump. They want to do the Insurrection Act last time there were protests over this issue. Maybe next time they'll actually do it. Because now, none of the brakes are on the car anymore. All the people who reeled Donald Trump in for his last 4 years, if he becomes president again, he's surrounded all by loyalists. So if he says Insurrection Act, he says martial law, they say yes, sir. Julian Assange. Look at what's going on with Julian Assange. Look at what happened with Edward Snowden. Where's our free speech rights? Look at all the anti-BDS laws on the books. You know, you couldn't get hurricane relief money unless you signed a pledge not to criticize Israel, not to boycott Israel. Where is our free speech? Where is our free protest? Where are our rights? I can't find him. So RFK Jr. and Donald Trump are now trading barbs. It's getting kind of spicy between the two of them. And I have many thoughts on this. So first, let's start with what RFK said about Trump. This was relatively unprompted, as far as I could tell. But he comes out the other day on Twitter and he says, President Trump calls me an ultra-left radical. I'm so liberal that his emissaries asked me to be his VP. I respectfully declined the offer. I am against President Trump, and President Biden can't win. Judging by his new website, it looks like President Trump knows who can actually beat him. Okay. So, number of thoughts on this here. The thing about him being asked to be Trump's VP, here's my perspective on it based on what I've read. I'm curious if you guys agree, but I think there are people who are close to Trump, like staffers who are kind of close to him, who those staffers are interested in that idea. So they reached out to him. I don't necessarily think it came right from Trump. In fact, I'd be surprised if it came from Trump. Because it doesn't, look, if you are Trump, it just doesn't make much sense. Because right now, what you're trying to do, you're trying to win over women, suburbanites. Trump has been clear for a long time, I'm going to pick a woman. That's why on the short list, you know, Carrie Lake was on the short list, Elise Stefanik, Kristi Noem, that's who I think it's going to be. But he would want somebody who is, obviously his number one criteria is loyal, but outside of that, he also wants a woman and somebody who's relatively moderate because he knows he's viewed as more extreme, right? So I think that's his thought process. So I don't really think Trump is steering the car there in terms of asking RFK. I think there are people who are part of the Trump campaign who like RFK and they are interested in maybe bringing that about. So they are trying to set up some sort of a meeting or whatever it is, right? That's my thoughts on it. I'm curious what you guys think. Do you think Trump is actually interested in picking RFK Jr.? Okay. So he says, I'm against President Trump and President Biden can't win. That's the strongest language I've ever heard yet for him against Trump. Because usually he more attacks Biden than attacks Trump. This is the first time he's doing more of the opposite here. It's almost like he's saying, I'm against President Trump. That's why I'm running. I don't think Biden can win. I'm trying to swoop in and save the day. That's like sort of the taste this leaves. And then he brings up Trump's website. I guess on Trump's website, it brings up RFK and goes after him or something. Okay. Anyway, this is the gist of it. Now, by the way, my thoughts on this are, it's actually not a good sign. The reason why there's a question as to whether or not RFK will take more votes from Trump or Biden is because RFK, most of his rhetoric is more right-wing coded than left-wing coded. He has way more people who lean conservative who support him than he has people who lean left. So if he does this, if he makes this switch up where now he tries to sound more liberal or tries to sound more leftist or goes after Trump a lot, then it does become more likely he will take more votes from Biden. The only thing making it so that he gets some liberal votes now is the Kennedy name is Democratic royalty, right? But if he now has that Democratic royalty name and he spends most of his time attacking Trump or saying left-wing coded things, then he will be more of a threat to Biden. See what I'm saying? So even though I agree with him more in substance here, attacking Trump more, the consequences of that are he might end up taking more votes from Biden. Right now, the evidence is mixed if he'll take more from Trump or Biden. Okay. So now let's get to Trump's response. This is fun. This is funny on so many levels. Here, let's dive in.
RFK Jr. is, as you know, the most radical left candidate in the race. He's more so than the Green Party. He's more so than even Crooked Joe Biden.
That is so untrue. He's the most radical left candidate in the debate, in the race. That's not true at all. Cornel West is way to the left of him. Jill Stein is way to the left of him. I think maybe he's a little left of Biden because there's some issues where he, like corporate capture, you could say he's to the left of Biden. But he's just like, Trump's just wrong. He just says shit. This is already great. I love it. It gets funnier. Wait for it.
He's got some nice things about him. I happen to like him.
This guy, he's horrible. Extremely far left, radical, bad guy, but I kind of like him. This is the most Trump thing ever. I love it so much.
Crooked Joe Biden, but he's got some nice things about him. I happen to like him. Unfortunately, he is about the Green New Scam because he believes in that, and a lot of people don't. They want to see our country.
He's for the Green New Scam. He believes in that, but a lot of people don't. I love it. He clearly does these in one take and just shoots from the hip. It's glorious. I absolutely love it. I love it. By the way, like old school RFK, yeah. Like back in the day, he was huge on environmental stuff, right? And fighting climate change. Now he's totally changed his tone on that. Now, if anything, he sounds more like climate change skeptical. So yeah, old school RFK was probably about the Green New Deal. New school RFK, he does the whole tap dance about like, well, you know, we should understand people who are skeptical on the question of climate change and so I don't even know. It's not true what he's saying.
Become rich and wealthy and strong and powerful and lots of other things and not waste money doing something that nobody wants and everybody knows doesn't work. I guess that would mean that RFK.
By the way, Trump's got a mean neckgina today. Look at that. That neckgina is just out there for the world to see, bro. Holy shit. He's definitely lost some weight. He's definitely lost some weight. There's been some pictures where people are speculating, is this Ozempic Trump? I mean, maybe, right? He definitely lost weight, but the neckgina is getting worse.
Junior is going to be taking away votes from Crooked Joe Biden, and he should because he's actually better than Biden. He's much better than Biden.
He's radical left. He's the furthest left, but I kind of like him, and he's better than Joe Biden.
If I were a Democrat, I'd vote for RFK Jr. every single time over Biden.
You see what he's trying to do here, right? Please, please, Democrats, vote for RFK. Take more votes from Biden than from me, please. That's the whole point.
He's frankly more in line with Democrats. RFK Jr.'s running mate, Nicole Shanahan, is also a very liberal person, but that's okay. She's got plenty of money from her ex-husband. Kennedy is a radical left Democrat and
it's a very liberal person, but that's okay. She's got plenty of money from her ex-husband. Go digging asshole. Go digging asshole. That's what we call her, folks. Go digging hoe.
RFK Jr.'s running mate, Nicole Shanahan, is also a very liberal person. But that's okay. She's got plenty of money from her ex-husband. Kennedy is a radical left Democrat and always will be, but he's a better man than Joe Biden, that I can tell you. It's great for MAGA. I hope he continues to run, but the communists will make it very hard on him. to get on the ballot, as they did for him as a Democrat. He wanted to get on the ballot. They made it very, very difficult for him. They really went after him viciously, just like they go after me.
He said the communists will make it difficult for him to get on the ballot. You mean the corporate Democrats? Those people aren't remotely communist. They're corporate hacks, just like you and your entire Republican Party, freak.
Welcome to the crowd, RFK Jr. But the fact is that the Democrats are vicious, communist, fascists. They're horrible people.
They're vicious, communist, fascists, totalitarian, Maoists. That's what they are, folks. They're Leninists. They're Marxist-Leninists. They're, can you tell me more labels, please? I want to give every label that I possibly can that sounds bad to the Democrats.
They really hurt him badly, what they did to him as a Democrat. That's why he's running as an independent. But expect him to be indicted any day now, probably for environmental fraud. He is Crooked Joe Biden's political opponent, not mine. Biden can't speak. Biden can't debate. Biden can't put two sentences together. So I guess he's probably going to indict RFK Jr. But I'm glad that he's running. They will fight it out together. We have the right and we have the center. And we have even center a little bit left, if you can believe it or not.
We have the right. We have the center. We even have the left, a little bit left, if you can believe it. Why is he so funny? It's not fair.
Because that group is radical left. They want windmills. They want...
I'm laugh coughing now. They want windmills. They want childcare. They want health care. How disgusting is that?
All sorts of things that are going to destroy our country, and we're not going to allow it. If you want to drive an all-electric car for a half an hour before you have to go home and get it charged, then you should vote for Joe Biden. But it's going to be interesting to watch the two of them fight it out. I do believe that RFK Jr. will do very well, and I do believe he's going to take a lot of votes away from Crooked Joe Biden. Thank you very much.
So, guys, the reason why he's doing this is because the polling is mixed on this. According to some polls, RFK actually takes more votes from Trump, right? There's also polls that show the opposite, that he takes more from Biden, but his attempt in doing this is to try to be like, please, liberals, lefties, you guys, ones who might vote for Biden, don't vote for Biden, vote for RFK so that RFK takes more votes from him. Like, that's the whole point of this. But it's so funny because it's so transparent, you know? His talking points are all over the place about this guy. Guys, remember, it was hilarious to me when as soon as, like, the first few polls came out that showed RFK was actually taking more votes from Trump, what happened? RFK, who became a superstar on Fox News, he was invited back on Fox News on Sean Hannity's show, and RFK went in there thinking it was going to be a patty cake session like it was before. Patty cake, bakers, man, ask me easy questions and I'll be a hack, right? Like, he was expecting that, but on a dime, Hannity flipped when the evidence showed, hey, you might actually hurt Trump more than Biden, and he started pelting him with questions about his past and bad things he did and bad policy positions that conservatives hate and just bah, bah, bah. And then now, you know, they're kind of in a similar place. It's just confusing, right? It's confusing. We don't know if he's going to help Trump or Biden more. But Trump clearly is afraid he's going to hurt him more, and that's kind of why he's doing this. But let's see. Let's see if RFK keeps hitting Trump. Like I said, the impact of that would probably be that eventually he would take more votes from Biden if now he starts saying things that are more liberal-coded or left-wing-coded and starts attacking Trump more. So in a weird way, you almost, you know, want RFK to stay more right-wing-coded and to attack Biden more because then that would take more votes from Trump. Does that make sense? You understand what I mean? So at the end of the day, who even knows how many ballots he's going to be on, right? It is so hard to get on the ballot as an independent. And, I think the Libertarians and the Greens are going to get on more ballots, for sure. Even though he's got the bigger name, he's polling higher. So it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds. All right, guys, that's the show. Everybody, what are you doing with your life? Subscribe to the channel. Just hook a brother up with that. We're trying to get to 10 million subs. It'll take a while, but you build it one at a time. Click the like button. Click that bell icon so you get a notification every time a video drops. All that fun stuff. You guys can listen to the show podcast style if you want over on Spotify. Just... you know, obviously you don't get the videos that way, but you can get the whole show as a podcast if you're so inclined. This week on Crystal Kyle and Friends, we have a pro-Palestine protester. He is Palestinian and he's been confronting members of Congress. You're definitely going to want to check that out. So subscribe to Crystal Kyle and Friends below on Substack. And that's all I got for you guys, man. Thank you to everybody who supports this show on Patreon. Thank you to everybody who tips with the thanks button on YouTube. You guys make it work. Again, I'm very proud. That's why I always tell you guys that I never have talked to an advertiser. It makes me very proud. I'm one of very few people in this space who do that. And so you guys help fund it from the ground up. You know, that's how we do it. That's how we do it. Small dollar donors, keep it rolling, do our thing. All right, love you guys. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Peace.